Come Again is my 30-episode audio series that addresses the biological, hormonal, and medical issues that can sabotage your sex life. This solution-driven, science-based series will help get libido to kick in and clitoral nerve endings to wake up. Come Again comes with loads of supplementary material and is intended for both healthcare professionals and the general public. Go to drstreicher.com/comeagain for more information. One out of 90 women will develop ovarian cancer in her lifetime. It's the second most common gynecologic cancer and the fifth leading cause of death among women from cancer. Roughly 25% of ovarian cancer is hereditary. If a woman is a carrier of one of the gene mutations associated with ovarian cancer, her risk is strikingly higher than the risk of the general population. But most women who carry this genetic mutation don't know it. Today's topic is how to know if you fall into that high-risk group, and if you do, what to do about it. And along the way, we'll also discuss the latest information on the prevention and detection of ovarian cancer if you don't have a genetic predisposition. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. People often ask me how I became interested in menopause. As a gynecologist, my area of interest was minimally invasive surgery, and I was one of the first in Chicago to offer outpatient laparoscopic hysterectomy. At the same time, my practice partner, Dr. Sherry Snow, developed an interest and expertise in genetic cancers. We were alarmed at the number of women who either had a personal history of cancer or had a family history of breast, ovarian, uterine, or other cancer who'd never been screened for genetic mutations. So we started to proactively screen every single woman who walked through our doors, even if it was just for vaginitis. We identified an enormous number of women with BRCA and other mutations, and when appropriate, counseled them to undergo ovary and tube removal when childbearing was complete or not desired. We saved a lot of lives, but we also put a lot of women into menopause and quickly learned that our post-op counseling was just as important as our pre-op counseling. And that's how I became interested and ultimately developed an expertise in menopause. Today, my guest is Dr. Michelle Jacobson, an internationally recognized expert in menopause and cancer survivorship, who has dedicated her professional life to educating women about hereditary cancer syndromes, who should be screened, and then what to do with that information. She's an assistant professor at the University of Toronto, the chief of OBGYN for Osler Health Systems, and the lead author of the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada's Clinical Guidelines on Menopause Management After Breast Cancer. And she is also the host of the Hysterical Women's Podcast. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me. But
the title of my first book was supposed to be Taking the Hysteria Out of Hysterectomy. And the publisher immediately changed it to The Essential Guide to Hysterectomy, which made me sad because both you and I know the word hysteria refers not just to something being funny, but refers to the uterus. I mean, hyster is the Greek root for uterus, which is why removal of the uterus is called hysterectomy. So I love that that's what you call your back.
Well, that's exactly right. It was exactly why we chose the title, because we're talking about all things women's health and we think we're pretty funny. And we also thought we should reclaim this word, right? Like, it doesn't need to have those negative connotations of a crazy woman. We want to be the funny, amazing, crazy women that we are.
I love it. I love it. And I can't wait to become a regular listener to your podcast. All right. We've got a lot to talk about. But I want to start, before we really dive into it, is with the basics, so that we're all talking the same language. Now, there are a lot of hereditary cancer syndromes, and we are going to talk about all of them a little. We're going to focus a little bit on the BRCA mutation, but start off just by explaining what is a hereditary cancer syndrome before we even go down the rest of this path.
Absolutely. So a hereditary cancer syndrome means that you have inherited or received from one or both of your parents, a change in your genetics and your DNA that makes you more vulnerable to developing cancer. Sometimes this is childhood cancer, sometimes this is adult cancer, and ethically it gets a lot more tricky about decision making when it's adult onset cancer. Most of the time we're talking about hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndromes if we're talking about women, and these tend to be changes in your genetics, again, that predispose to developing cancer in breast cancer, in ovarian cancer, and sometimes other cancers as well.
So BRCA, BRCA. Start by telling us, what is a BRCA gene? I mean, we have normal BRCA genes. I think people hear BRCA and they automatically think that there's something terribly wrong, but people have BRCA genes that are completely normal. So what's the purpose of a BRCA gene?
Absolutely. So it's always funny that people will say, oh my God, you have BRCA? Well, we all have BRCA, right? The problem comes when you have a mutation or a change in a BRCA gene that then causes proteins to be abnormally shaped or abnormal function. So the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, which are usually the ones that we talk about because those are the ones we know about right now, are each located on different chromosomes, so different parts of your body's DNA, chromosome 17 for what it's worth for BRCA1 and chromosome 13 for BRCA2. And primarily the proteins that the BRCA or BRCA gene make are responsible for making sure that when DNA is fixed, there are no mistakes made. So we call this homologous recombination. And what it means is that every time you get a scratch and your skin needs to heal, or you're healing from a surgery, or you get a sunburn, your body needs to put all those cells back together. And when that's happening, mistakes can be made. BRCA is supposed to stop mistakes from being made.
So we like our BRCA genes.
Yeah, we all want to be BRCA.
We all want to have BRCA. Yes. The problem is if the BRCA gene gets mutated.
Exactly. So if there's a problem with one or both of your BRCA genes, then you have a problem with the way your DNA repairs itself. And those DNA repairs, when there are mistakes made, is typically what causes cancer. So you can imagine that if everybody receives one copy of their BRCA1 gene from their mom and one copy from their dad, that if you receive two normal copies, you're good. Cancer can still happen, but two mistakes have to be made in your BRCA genes for those mistakes to happen. If you already get one that has a problem, you're already running not on your full steam, your BRCA genes are not working properly, and it takes very little for mistakes to be made to then cause cancer down the road.
Yeah, I'm so glad you also mentioned that men have BRCA genes as well as BRCA mutations. And while we are both gynecologists and we're going to be talking about women today, I'm just going to mention right at the beginning as we move on that this also applies to men. The numbers are different. Men can't get ovarian cancer, but certainly men can have BRCA mutations and are at increased risk of cancer. You know, when I wrote my hysterectomy book and I just looked back at my chapter on BRCA mutations. And at that time, I said that the likelihood of a BRCA mutation was about 10 to 15%. And today it's closer to 25%. Are we better at detecting it, or are there more mutations?
We're probably getting better at detecting it. And when you talk about how prevalent or how common it is to find a BRCA mutation, first of all, you're wondering, who am I testing? Am I only testing people who, you know, we're going to talk about this, are likely to be carriers? Am I testing everybody, in which case I'm going to find the general populations? Am I testing only groups that are likely to carry these mutations? And so I'm going to find it more likely, like women who have ovarian cancer.
Right. But my question is, if we just take the general population, all comers, right now, what is the prevalence, as we understand it, of having a BRCA mutation? Do we have a number?
We don't have a number because almost nowhere is population testing done. It's still hard to access testing. And so we don't know what the general population has. We know certain populations get tested more frequently. There are certain countries in the world that do population testing, but they do that because the yield is high, because the people in that country come from an ethnic background where they're more likely to carry it.
In the United States, we do not have universal testing. We only test for folks that are at risk. How about Canada?
Canada, no universal testing, and it's province by province, which is like state by state, to determine how you get tested, who gets access. But countries like Israel, where they have a higher population of BRCA carriers, because it runs in families from certain ethnic backgrounds, have better rates detected because they test everybody.
If someone has a BRCA mutation, how much does that increase their risk of developing breast or ovarian cancer?
So the general population's breast cancer risk, if they had no other risk factors, is about 1 in 8.
If they have to be old though, right? To get to that point.
Yeah, to get to that point. That's your lifetime risk of developing breast cancer. Yeah. If you carry a BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene, your lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is more like 70 to 80%.
Wow.
Yeah.
How about ovarian cancer?
So for BRCA1, the risk for ovarian, and when we say ovarian, I think it's really important. We're not just talking about ovarian cancer. We're talking about the type of cancer that looks like ovarian cancer, which is ovaries, fallopian tubes, and the lining of the abdomen, the peritoneum. So these high-grade serous cancers, we have about a 40 to 50% risk in BRCA1 and a 15 to 20% lifetime risk in BRCA2.
Yeah. And certainly we are going to talk a little bit about the breasts and prevention of breast cancer and surveillance. But I do want to focus today a little bit more on ovarian, because first of all, I want to talk about the management of menopause after people have their ovaries removed if they choose to go that route. And the detection of ovarian cancer is challenging, and therefore it makes it even more important that we're aggressive in people that have such a high risk. And I think one of the first things I'd like to point out is that most women that develop ovarian cancer who do not have a genetic mutation are older, I think, in their 60s, 70s, really. And if someone carries a BRCA mutation, what age group are we looking at for the development of ovarian cancer?
That's a great point, because
I'm not talking about the whole constellation. And perineal.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, you're 100% right. Our BRCA carriers develop ovarian cancers much earlier. So BRCA1, your risk starts to increase above the general population's risk at about 35 years of age. So this is so young, right? Women haven't always completed their families. They're young to be going through menopause prematurely, but that is when the rate starts to rise. If you took out every BRCA1 carrier's tubes and ovaries, you'd find cancer about 1% of the time. And if you took them out at 40, you'd find cancer about 4 to 5% of the time. So there's a pretty steep rise for a BRCA1 carrier between 35 and 40 years of age, compared to 1.5% risk in the general population, where that risk starts to increase more in the 60s, as you said.
Yeah. So it really acts very, very differently in this population.
Very different. BRCA2, a little bit better news. Risk starts to increase at 40 years of age. So if you took out everyone's tubes and ovaries for BRCA2, you'd find cancer about 1% of the time. And by 50, that risk is about 4%. So that same rise from 1% to the lifetime risk of 20% happens between ages 40 and 70. In BRCA1, it happens between 35 and 70, but it goes from 1% to 50%.
So you mentioned that some families are more at risk than others, and I'm sure people are just waiting to hear if they might be in one of those high-risk groups. So what are the red flags that should make someone say, maybe I should get screened? And then we'll talk about what that screening is, but what are the red flags?
So this is such an important conversation, especially if you're doing primary care and you're looking after patients. The question is, how do I identify a high-risk family? And so we want to be focused on the family history that we know about. And that family history is sometimes vague. People lived in other countries. We don't have clear history. Nobody talked about it. So you have to be a bit of a detective. The things that you're going to be looking for are younger breast cancer. So breast cancer maybe that happened under 50 or 40 years of age, recurrent breast cancer, people who died of breast cancer young before menopause, any kind of ovarian cancer in your family. And sometimes the older generations will talk about the cancer that got grandma, stomach cancer, we don't know, abdominal cancer.
Cancer all over.
She was gone, right? Like they, it's really hard to describe when you don't know what your grandmother went through. And otherwise the other types of cancers, because you can get this from your dad, right? Like you pointed out, BRCA affects men as well. And a lot of people are under the impression that they can only inherit that bad gene from their mothers. This is totally not true. I myself inherited my BRCA1 mutation from my father, and you can inherit it from your father. And if you don't have a lot of female family members, you may not know about the breast and ovarian cancer history. So here we're going to be thinking more about pancreas cancer, gallbladder cancer, prostate cancer, and melanoma, so skin cancer as well.
What do you tell women who are adopted and have no knowledge of their biologic family, or just don't have any access at all?
This is so hard because we can only really go by family history to know if you're high risk. This is where sometimes you can go ahead and get tested regardless. The problem with these tests is if your test comes back negative, this is really hard. It's a hard concept, so I'm going to say it really slowly. If you don't know if your mom or dad carried a mutation and then you get tested and your test is negative, then your test is what's called an uninformative negative. Because either your mom and dad never carried a gene, so of course you didn't either, or your mom had a gene and her risk was high, but you didn't have the gene, you didn't inherit it, so your risk is now back to the populations. So that's why it's so important, if you have knowledge of your family history, to test the person who was actually affected by cancer and not to just go out and access testing yourself, because it's not always the most informative to get a test if you don't know what their mom or your dad had in their history. So without that information, if you're adopted or you don't have any living family or access to that information, you're stuck with really evaluating your other risk factors for breast and ovarian cancer. Some of these are modifiable, some of them are not. So things like when you got your period for the first time, or how old you were when you had your first pregnancy, if you're overweight, how much alcohol you drink, all these risk factors for breast cancer. And the only thing you can really do within your power is improve the modifiable risk factors, the weight, the smoking, the alcohol, etc.
And explain why it's important, if someone has a personal diagnosis of breast cancer, that they still get tested, because they might be thinking, why should I get tested? I've already got it. So explain, make a case for that.
This is so important because your treatment will actually differ if you carry a hereditary cancer mutation. So let's take someone with breast cancer, for example. First of all, if they have kids or other family members who may be affected, then it's important to test, because your knowledge becomes power for your family members to get screened, to get tested, to have preventive surgeries. You may be saving your family member's life. Now, if you don't care about your family or you don't have family and you're just focused on you, it's important to still get tested, because there is an actual separate set of drugs called PARP inhibitors that take advantage of the way your DNA is shaped with a BRCA mutation and actually improve your recovery and your survival and the likelihood of cancer recurrence if you are a carrier of one of these genes.
Yeah. Well, not to mention, if someone has breast cancer, it'd be nice to know that they're also at risk for ovarian cancer, because that's going to change decisions they make along those lines. So it is important to know. I think a lot of people are worried that if they get tested, that they're somehow going to get their insurance canceled or have problems. And in the United States, the GINA Act was passed many years ago so that people cannot be penalized in any way, insurance-wise, work-wise, anything, if they have been tested and have a genetic mutation. Is that the case in Canada as well?
It's the case as well. It's the case many places around the world, and even more than insurance purposes. If you're tested and you know about a gene, then you have access to the right kind of screening and it'll be covered by insurance.
That's right.
So in Canada, this is less important, but you can access certain types of screenings if you're identified at high risk. In America, presuming you have insurance, if you are identified as high risk, then it would be covered for you to get the right kind of tests.
So one last thing, when we talk about red flags, you briefly mentioned Israel. If you live someplace that there's a lot more, but you're more likely to get tested. And certainly we do know that certain ethnic groups are at higher risk than others. And Ashkenazi Jews are in that group. And Ashkenazi, for those who are not clear on the difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardic, Ashkenazi is basically Eastern European Jews, are at higher risk. So how much higher is the risk in the Ashkenazi Jewish population? And even more important, does that mean that only Ashkenazi Jews should get tested?
So the risk that we know about is higher in the Ashkenazi Jewish population. It's probably more like 1 in 15 to 1 in 20. We only know this because of population testing, so we can't really compare it to the rest of the world, because we don't know how common these gene mutations are in other populations. But certainly Ashkenazi is not the only type of ethnic background. There are other pockets of people around the world that will carry these mutations in a higher prevalence. And there are also lots of people that we don't know about because we don't test. So the ones
we know
about.
Not to mention, you don't really know who grandma was sleeping with. I'm just
exactly,
saying.
Exactly, that too. Yeah. Well, I heard some like terrifying statistic once about how like 10% of pregnancies are fathered by people they think they didn't know were their father or something like that. Like shocking. But in Canada, we've got a big French Canadian population. Yeah. So this is somewhere where we see more BRCA mutations. In Colorado and New Mexico, I think you've got populations of folks who have higher prevalences. This tends to be something that is called a founder mutation. So a founder mutation means that back in the day when there was some immigration from one place to another, one of the people who was one of the primary immigrants who then had a lot of ancestors be related to them down the road passed that mutation on in higher rates.
Yeah. You know, I remember hearing somewhere along the lines that, oh, you know, Black women don't need to be tested because they don't have this mutation. And that is simply not true. It is absolutely not true. So anyone that has a significant family history, as you pointed out, it doesn't matter what their race or ethnicity is, they need to be screened. Now, I want to walk through the journey of someone who's been screened and who's positive, and then also the person who is screened and negative, but still worried about ovarian cancer. But if someone is at risk, and when the screening that we're talking about initially is basically doing a questionnaire, a family history to see if they're at risk. And then depending on that, then they would move forward and have actual blood screening. So if someone is at risk based on their family history, at what age do you think it's appropriate to screen someone? And this comes up a lot because we have mothers who are fathers who know that they are carrying a mutation. And they have a 12-year-old daughter or a 12-year-old son and are saying, okay, when do I tell them? When do they get tested?
It's such a great question, and it's so difficult to answer how old you should be when you talk to your kids about this, because every family is different, every kid is different, how worried they are going to be and where that anxiety is going to weigh on them is different. Personally, I talked to my kids from the time they were very young about this because I'd gone through some preventive surgeries. I wanted them to know that this could be in their future. So we started talking in really, really kind of abstract terms, you know, mommy's got balloons instead of boobs. And do you know, mommy did that to be safe. Do you think if you needed to do that, that you would consider doing that one day? So we started having these conversations at a high level, really, really young. But when it comes to being tested, you have to, in Canada at least, and I assume this is true elsewhere in the world, from an ethical perspective, be an adult to test for adult onset mutations. So that means that because these cancers tend to happen to adults, we don't test children. We only test children if it's going to impact them when they're children. So usually 18 is the youngest that you can be tested to see if you carry a BRCA mutation. And part of that is also because if you have a mutation, you want the ability to do something about it. So from a screening perspective, which we'll talk about later, you would only really start doing this into your adult years. Yeah.
And last question about screening, because I know we got to move on. If someone was screened, say, 15 years ago, and they were told you're negative. Obviously, someone's genetics doesn't change, but new mutations that we've discovered has changed. So how often, if at all, should someone be rescreened if they are at risk but have screened negative in the past?
If you have been screened and found to be positive, you don't need to test again.
Right.
So if you carry the gene, there isn't a reason to go back and get tested again. But if you were tested and you were told that you don't carry a genetic mutation, or you were tested and told you have something called a VUS, a variant of an unknown significance, then it's worth touching base with your genetic counselor about every 5 years or so. Because just as you said, Dr. Stryker, you know, our library changes, our vocabulary changes. We learn more about new genetic mutations. We test for ones now that we didn't test for 15 years ago. Back then, it was only BRCA 1 and 2. Now it's 20 genes on the hereditary cancer panel. So it's definitely worth touching base and finding out, did I get all the testing that's currently available? And if not, can it be rerun?
Yeah. And I just want to mention for folks in the US that if your own clinician cannot direct you where to go, any major medical center is going to do genetic testing and generally will have counselors in a department to help you out with that. All right. So let's move on and talk about the journey of someone who has been identified as carrying a BRCA mutation, a BRCA mutation. And again, we know there's a lot of other ones, but I want to focus on this for the moment. So let's start with talking about the woman who's in her 20s, single, not ready to get pregnant. What are you going to advise her to do to protect her ovaries and protect herself for down the road?
So I think in this kind of a scenario, we're talking about someone who has not had breast cancer yet, because unfortunately, some of our young patients in their 20s will actually be diagnosed with breast cancer first, and then will get tested for the gene and find out that they have it. So that's not exactly who we're talking about. We're talking about somebody who was tested maybe because they knew their mom or dad carried the gene, they found out that they're a carrier, and now they have a lot of important decisions to make. So number one, how do I protect myself from ovarian cancer? There is very little that we can do, but there are some things. And one thing that we know is that taking birth control pills continuously for 5 years or more leads to a significant decrease in your lifetime risk of developing ovarian cancer. So it's decreased by about 50%, which is tremendous for people who take birth control pills for a while. People,
and it was 5-0, everybody, not 1-5.
5-0, yeah.
5-0.
50%. And that's, and because there's so little else that we can do, and as we'll talk about, so little screening we can do, this is a tremendous thing that you can do. It will not only give you the contraception that you might need, but it will also reduce your risk for ovarian cancer. People always worry, what if I get breast cancer because I'm taking my birth control pills? We actually have no evidence to suggest that if you take birth control pills, even as a BRCA carrier, that you are at a higher risk of developing breast cancer. And remember, unfortunately, if you're a carrier, your breast cancer risk is really high in the first place. So little things don't change that risk in a meaningful way. But you can do so little to protect your ovaries. This is one thing you can do, and that's what we would suggest. So from a protection perspective, birth control.
And I do want to emphasize that certainly women who have a genetic mutation, this is a strategy. It's also a strategy for women in general. People forget that taking birth control pills for 5 years or more in the general population is going to dramatically decrease their risk of ovarian cancer down the road. Yeah. All right. Should they be freezing their eggs?
Yeah. So this is something that you want to think about as well. You can freeze eggs, and then down the road when you create embryos, so when sperm gets mixed with those eggs and turned into embryos, you can test those embryos to see if they carry the same genetic mutation. This is called pre-implantation genetic mutation testing. It means you can actually know that you're putting only BRCA negative gene embryos into your uterus to carry a pregnancy. So this is something that's offered for carriers that is not necessarily offered for all other people. So this is a nice option if you are looking to screen out for the genetic mutation. The other thing that freezing eggs does when you're young is allows you to keep eggs frozen in case you do get breast cancer. Because if you get breast cancer at a young age, and many of our carriers will end up needing chemotherapy, this can put you into an earlier menopause or decrease the number of eggs you have left, compromising your ability to be pregnant in the future. So it's not for everyone. Definitely there are financial implications. There are ethical implications for some people. But if you are open to it, if you are interested in it and you can afford it, it is a very reasonable option.
And the reason that I brought it up, because people don't think of doing it in their 20s. You know, people think of it more in their 30s. But certainly, I think it's a discussion to be had in the 20s for all the reasons you just gave, in addition to the fact that the younger those eggs are when you freeze them, the better they are. The better they are, the more likely they are to end up as a viable pregnancy. So if you know that you have a mutation, in my point of view, it's never too soon to freeze your eggs, whether you think you're going to have babies or not. You know, this is insurance. It's not, you don't have to make that decision right then. Not everybody chooses to have children, but it gives you that option down the road. All right. So let's fast forward a little bit. So now our patient is in her mid 30s. She's had her 2.5 kids and she is trying to figure out what she should do now about her ovaries, because she's young and she's really confused. So what would you tell her?
Yeah, so she's confused, she's scared, she doesn't know what to do. She's afraid of so many things, right? She's afraid of ovarian cancer. She's afraid of going into menopause early if she takes her ovaries out. She's probably also afraid of breast cancer. And she's probably worried for her kids if she didn't do the pre-implantation testing. So there's lots on your mind. Number one, we don't want to forget about the fact that you're doing your breast screening or you've had breast surgery. So in the background, from the time you identified the gene, you can be doing breast screening with mammograms and MRIs, which is very good at picking up breast cancer early. It doesn't protect you from getting breast cancer, so your risk is still high, but it picks it up early, and that helps you to not become very sick from breast cancer. You can treat it. If, however, you get ovarian cancer, the likelihood of survival is fairly low. So most ovarian cancers are diagnosed late. Most are diagnosed in the third or the fourth stage, which means that the survival is poor, and we cannot screen for ovarian cancer. We don't have any means of testing, whether it's imaging or blood tests, that reliably picks up ovarian cancer early. So
I want to stop right there, because this is such an important point. People have this idea that if they get an annual CA125, which is a blood test, or they get an ultrasound of their ovaries, that they can be reassured that they're fine. And I hate to burst that bubble, but can you please go and burst that bubble?
Yeah, it is so scary because you're being falsely reassured. First of all, this has been studied. So we've tested this. We know that if you do frequent CA125s, ultrasounds, MRIs, the whole nine yards, you are not likely to pick up ovarian cancer earlier. But I'm going to share something with you that actually nobody else knows because I haven't published it yet. And that is, in all of the patients that we operate on in my BRCA program in Toronto, we do an ultrasound and a CA125 right before the surgery, like a day before the surgery. Yeah. And in every case where the patient has come back showing stage 0, 1, or even 2 cancer, the ultrasound and the CA125 from 48 hours before were negative. They were normal.
Wow, that's so interesting. I mean, I remember being told the statistic that 50% of stage 1 ovarian cancers have a normal CA125, but
in my experience, it is 100%.
Wow. Wow. I mean, listen, that's crazy. Let me know when you publish that, because I'm going to put that out there, because the world needs to know that. That is so important. And this is particularly, I mean, it's one thing to get a CA125 or ultrasound if you're at high risk, because quite frankly, we don't have anything else to offer other than removal. But for the general population, unless someone has a reason, you know, a symptom or concern, but just to do it as, oh, I'm here for my annual exam, can you do a CA125? Just absolutely makes no sense. Okay, so besides removing ovaries, and we're going to get to that in a second, as you mentioned, what we're also talking about is tubal cancer. And in fact, ovarian cancer generally starts in the tubes. So something that comes up a lot is people say, well, I don't want to be thrust into a surgical menopause. How about if you just remove my tubes? Talk about that, please.
So this is the like ultimate goal, right? Like everyone's like, please let this be true. If we just take out the tubes and that's all we have to do, then we're golden. We can take the ovaries out later and never deal with menopause that we're worried about. Like this is what everybody wants to be true so, so desperately, myself included. We don't know yet. And it's going to take so many years to know for certain that this is a regimen that works and still allows you to not get ovarian cancer. So for the people who are ready to choose ovaries and tubes coming out, I want to be really clear that that's still the gold standard and the recommendation. And that if you are going to do what's called a two-step procedure, which means taking out the fallopian tubes, letting them go off to the pathologist to be looked at under the microscope, keeping your ovaries because it makes your hormones, and later coming back for your ovaries, that should ideally be done in the setting of a research study. Now, there are research studies going on. If you live somewhere where you have access to be enrolled in one of these research studies, that's wonderful. America has some, the Netherlands has sites, and they're ongoing now. But if you are just a regular carrier who's faced with making these really, really challenging decisions, and you just don't know what to do, and you're not ready for the ovaries to come out, there are lots of people who are willing to take out the fallopian tubes, knowing that, just like the birth control pill, it's going to give you some risk reduction. We just don't know by how much.
We don't know. But how about if someone gets a tubal ligation, not removing the tube, but basically just blocking the tube, which we do for contraception, but we do have some data that shows that that also decreases risk, correct? And do we have any idea by how much?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. And this is in all comers, which means not just in people who carry mutations, but in all women who have a tubal ligation. I like to call this worst case scenario. So worst case scenario means a tubal ligation buys you about a 30%, 30, risk reduction, which is pretty good, right?
Pretty good.
It's pretty good. Your risk in life is 50%. You decrease it by 30. Maybe you're in the realm of like 35-ish% now. Still not great odds, but we'll take it. Then there's taking out the fallopian tube altogether. And if we really believe that taking out the fallopian tube altogether decreases the risk of ovarian cancer completely because it starts in the tube, then I'd call that best case scenario. And that would be about a 90 to maybe 100% risk reduction for ovarian cancer. So our best estimate is between 30 and 90%. It's somewhere in the middle. And what's really interesting is there was one research study done that was a statistical model research study that looked at both scenarios, best case and worst case. And they said that if you take out the tubes at 35 in BRCA1 and the ovaries at 40, or the tubes at 40 in BRCA2 and the ovaries at 45, you are statistically, best and worst case scenario, not more likely to die of ovarian cancer. So sometimes we use this kind of information to make decisions.
No, that's hugely, hugely helpful. So the other surgical decision that people need to make if they choose to go the route of having both their tubes and ovaries removed prophylactically, then we come to the uterus. And I have very strong feelings about that. But before I say my strong feelings, I would like to hear what you have to say about removal of the uterus.
Well, I'm a guest on your podcast, so I don't want to say the wrong thing, but
there's no wrong answer here. This is all just for discussion.
So I like to follow evidence as much as possible. And yet at the same time, you know, sometimes what you would tell your sister or your mother or yourself is different than what the evidence tells us. So if we look at the evidence, we see that overall, there is not a higher rate of endometrial or uterine cancer in our carriers. But in our carriers who develop endometrial cancer, more of them get a worse type, high-grade serous uterine cancer, than the general population. And this makes sense because this type of endometrial cancer looks a lot like fallopian tube and ovarian cancer under the microscope. And so the question is, should you have your uterus removed because of this information? And there are lots of people who say, look, you're a gynecologist, you're operating on me, you're going to be there anyway, take it all. And others who say, I don't want to take anything out that I don't have to. I'm already faced with this really difficult decision, and I would rather do the bare minimum. Your recovery is faster if you don't take out your uterus. Your long-term pelvic floor function is a little bit better if you don't take out your uterus, according to the studies that we have. Again, what I would do for myself may not even be the same as what I would tell somebody to do. But if you just are like a purist and you're following the NCCN guidelines, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, there is not a recommendation to routinely take out the uterus. That being said, there are a lot of arguments to be made, and I'm sure you're going to make them shortly, on why it can be a really good decision.
I have not said a word. How do you already know that I'm on team take out your uterus? Yes, I'm on team take out your uterus for all of the reasons you said, but the other huge reason is we are putting these young women into surgical menopause. And from my point of view, every single one of them needs to get estrogen to protect their bones, their brain, their sex life, etc. We're going to talk about that. I would really rather that their uterus wasn't there, so I don't need to worry about giving that woman a progesterone. I don't need to worry about abnormal bleeding, and I don't need to worry about any of these long-term problems, because we are looking at young women that are in it for the long haul. And the easiest, safest way to give estrogen therapy, quite frankly, is in the women who does not have a uterus. And when we talk about a longer recovery, I would maintain that in the hands of an expert laparoscopic surgeon, minimally invasive surgery, that the difference in complications is teeny, teeny, tiny, almost non-existent. And that in the right hands for a laparoscopic minimally invasive procedure, the recovery is only slightly longer. So it's always the woman's choice, always. Having said that, I think it's important to give that point of view as well, because as I know you and I are on the same page with this, that the time to talk about what happens after is before, not when someone comes in a month later flashing and miserable. So that's part of this discussion, is let's talk about if we're going to do hormone therapy, how we're going to do that, and what is going to be the safest for the long term. So that's my take.
100%. I agree with you completely. Everything, like nothing that you said is different than what I said. It's really the patient's choice. We want to give them informed consent, give them all the information they need to make the best possible decision for them. And I agree, as a menopause specialist, of course, my life would be way easier if all I had to give them was estrogen.
Yeah. This is something I used to do that I don't know if anyone else ever does this. My partners and I just kind of made this up and we did this. But most of our patients who had a BRCA mutation, these young women, they were on birth control pills for all the reasons you stated. And generally what happens is when you do surgery, especially if you are removing ovaries and taking out a uterus, you usually stop birth control pills because you don't need them anymore. Well, our approach was we don't want someone to recover from surgery and have to redo their hormones at the same time. So we would tell our patients who are on birth control pills, you know what, just keep taking those birth control pills for another month or so, and then so you won't have any difference in your hormone levels. You'll feel perfectly fine other than recovering from the surgery. And then when you feel fully physically recovered from your surgery, then we're going to start to mess with your hormones. I know that is not what is presented in the medical literature. I know that is not a recommendation. I'm just throwing that out there as something we used to do that anecdotally really kind of worked well for us and for our patients. I think they were very appreciative of the fact that they were not going into a surgical menopause at the same time as they were recovering from surgery. So I'm just throwing that out there, which will probably make the clinicians out there crazy if patients then come and ask about that. So
I think like whatever works for the patient, for you, it makes good sense. I start my patients on the hormone therapy right away. I certainly don't wait. I don't think we need to worry in the average risk patient about starting estrogen and blood clot risk when you're 35 years old. Like they should not have to have a single hot flash as far as I'm concerned.
And I know we are on the same page of this, but I think we really need to be so loud and clear and proactive to say that it is not controversial. It is not controversial that we give women with a known BRCA mutation who are in a surgical menopause, that it is not controversial that they should get estrogen therapy.
100%. Like, say it loud and clear. You are going to be supported by every guideline body that puts out recommendations for this. I'm going to say it again just for posterity. Regardless of whether women have their breasts or not, if they have a mutation and they do not have a personal history of breast cancer, they should be offered hormone therapy for their surgical menopause.
That's right. And not only is there no increase in their risk of breast cancer, but there is even some data that suggests if they get particularly the combination of a conjugated equine estrogen and basodoxifen, Duovay, that they have a decrease. And I just had a Substack article on that about an article that came out about a very recent study. So I will put that link. But the memo's not getting out. I mean, there have been studies. There's that 2024 survey that only 70% of Italian gynecologic oncologists thought that it was okay to give BRCA mutation women estrogen. There was a Canadian study. I don't remember the year of that one. I think it was pretty recent, though. Yep. That only 50% of women took hormones post-surgery, and most of them stopped within a year. Clearly not your patients. How do we get the word out?
I don't know what more we can do. I feel like all I do is go on podcasts and write guidelines and give continuing education about this, and like it's still not getting out there. Like, if the thing you're worried about,
it's not just about hot flashes. I think that's the point that we need to make is, yes, it's miserable to go through a surgical menopause. There's no perimenopause, by the way. Everyone talks about perimenopause, very hot topic now. And I heard someone say, oh, everyone goes through perimenopause. They do not. Women who have their ovaries removed go right post-menopause. There is no peri. And these young women are the most symptomatic. And I'll let you take it from here, the other issues of women who enter a surgical menopause and in their 30s.
Yeah, like, and across the board, the guidelines support you with this also. You should be giving hormone therapy to women who go through menopause prematurely, even if they don't have symptoms, because we need to protect their bones, their heart, and their brain. And we have strong evidence to tell us that hormone therapy protects your bone and your heart and your brain when you take it for every year you go through menopause before age 45.
Now, this is the other thing that comes up. These are young women who are pumping out large amounts of hormones. Standard menopausal hormone therapy is really low. People forget that. They hear words like replacement. It's not replacement. It's therapy, meaning they're getting very, very small dosages of estrogen and of progestogen if they need it. Mm-hmm. So the question is in these young women, do you put them on standard menopausal hormone therapy doses or do you go higher?
What a great question and what a clinical conundrum, right? So what you're talking about and a great table for people who are looking is in the 2020 International Menopause Society white paper by Nick Panay, there is an amazing table that looks at standard hormone therapy doses, compares them to premature ovarian insufficiency doses, just so you can get a sense of how much you should be using for our younger patients. Now, the thing that makes us all a little bit question this is, if I've got this younger patient and I should be giving her these higher doses, am I worried because maybe higher doses are going to be associated with more breast cancer or something? There's no evidence for that. If you're going to treat your patient, you should treat her with the doses that are recommended to protect her brains, her heart, her bones, except, and I'll make this as a little caveat, what you just referred to, which is the Premarin and Bezadoxifene combination, Duave or Duavive in Canada. This is a relatively low dose of estrogen, and yet its breast profile is so good that I think all of us who are in the know are a little bit like, I like this for my BRCA carriers, even though it's a relatively low dose. And I look in the mirror and convince myself that the bezadoxifene is going to do a better job on the bones, so I don't need to worry too much about it. So I think there's still an argument to be made that Duavive might still be Duave in the States a good option for these women, even though the dose is low.
Yeah, and the dose in Duave is only 0.45, the standard menopause dose. We usually start at a 0.625. I wish they had a second dose. I've talked to other people about, can you add estrogen on top of that to control vasomotor symptoms? And the answer always is, we don't know if the bezadoxifene is going to protect the lining of the uterus. Another reason to remove the uterus. I just thought I would throw that out there. Okay. In the time we have left, because we could go on for hours, and I think I'm going to have you back another time, but you know, we've been talking a lot about BRCA mutations, and that's not the only one. There are other hereditary mutations that women in particular need to know about. We don't have time to go through them all, but maybe you can mention just a few of the ones that women really need to be aware of.
So we call these actionable ovarian cancer mutations. These are going to be ones where there's evidence to take ovaries out because the risk is higher. So this is going to be things like certain Lynch mutations, which we could talk about for a whole nother episode. And then the uterus should definitely come out too, for what it's worth. BRIP, BRIP1. RAD51, C and D, and arguably also PALB2, PALB2, sometimes one called ATM. The list is ever growing. It's also available on the NCCN website, and it changes regularly. There are more mutations that I didn't just mention that predispose to breast cancer, but not ovarian. But these are the ovarian cancer mutations that we know about.
I am going to ask you for those links to put in the program notes. And one other thing I want to throw out about Lynch syndrome, which a lot of women have not heard about. The other red flag for Lynch is colon cancer. You know, people very often, they don't talk about, quote, down there cancers, you know, gynecologic cancers, because they're embarrassed or it's the family secret. But people are more prone to talk about colon cancers. And certainly we are seeing an uptick of colon cancers in this country, particularly in young folks, which is concerning. These are not all because of genetic mutations. We're not sure why. But the point is there's a lot of colon cancer out there. And sometimes it is a genetic mutation. And the Lynch syndrome is a genetic mutation that is an increase in colon and uterine and ovarian also for Lynch, correct?
For certain mutations. Yeah. And can I take a minute and just say something? Because I really want to make sure that the people listening don't feel abandoned if they have breast cancer. Because we've talked so much about how important hormone therapy is for our mutation carriers who have their ovaries out early. And yet there's a big population of these patients who've had breast cancer. That's how they were diagnosed, or they got breast cancer along the way, and they can't or shouldn't take hormones a lot of the time. There are always rooms to be made for argument. And they might be listening to us thinking like, all is lost, I'm going to die, right? This is not the case. We can do our best. We can treat you for symptoms, and we can modify your risk factors, and we can treat you for protection for your heart and your bones in different ways. It is not like because you can't take hormones or shouldn't take hormones that your life is over. And so please don't despair.
I am so glad you brought that up, because there's this general feeling for women, breast cancer or not, that if they don't take hormone therapy, that they are doomed to die a premature, horrible death. Nothing could be further than the truth. And as you said, for women who do have a breast cancer diagnosis, particularly if it's hormone negative or if it's remote, some cases with shared decision making, estrogen therapy, hormone therapy is an option. I have information on that on my Substack, Current Men, who a lot of people know I work with, also has wonderful information about that. But if you choose not to, then we find other approaches. And people say, okay, well, what do you substitute with? It depends on your concern. If you're having hot flashes, then we have these new non-hormonal neurokinin antagonists, and I have a bunch of information on that. We have things that can help your bones. So really what it comes down to is, we're always returning to this, is to work with an expert who can give you information instead of just saying that's the way it is, be lucky, happy you're alive, and send you on your way. So, you know, as in a final thing, a lot of people say, I'd rather not have this information. It's scary. I don't want to know. And you can always slay the dragon you see coming. You can't slay the dragon you can't see coming. Information is power. Thank you for sharing this information with us. I look forward to listening to your podcast. Tell everybody where they can find you.
Well, we are on all the usual podcast places, Apple, Spotify. It's called Hysterical Women. I talk about my own journey, discovering my own BRCA mutation and how it led to this career in hereditary cancer prevention. So please do have a listen. And I'm very excited to listen to this podcast and all the others. And I'm extremely grateful. You don't know this, but I'm a big fan. I've been a big fan of you for many years since I saw you at the IMS in Portugal. And I'm fangirling.
Oh, you were there. Myself. Are you going to Rio this year?
Convince me. Yeah. Maybe.
I'm giving three talks. Yeah. So please come to Rio. It's going to be great fun. I've never been to Rio and I would love to see you there in person. That would be so great. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for the work that you do. It's so important. And I'm so excited about your new research study. Please, the minute it is available, send it to me and we'll get it out there.
Thanks so much.